not a sprain or an itch. Pain, rash, swelling, or twitch, call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky, I call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, Medical Director of Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. You may not know it, but the media appears to be doing a disservice to the public as it announces the new aspirin guidelines created by the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association for the primary prevention of cardiovascular disease. Now, according to the two groups, they no longer recommend that healthy adults without cardiovascular disease take daily aspirin for the primary prevention of cardiovascular disease. The emphasis here is on the word primary.
In normal everyday use, the term primary means the first, main, or principal. For example, primary school or primary purpose, most of us know what those terms mean.
Disease prevention can be divided into two types, primary and secondary prevention. In this case, the term primary prevention refers to the total effort to prevent an event that an individual has never had in the past. A good example of primary prevention is administration of vaccines, which help protect against contracting a disease in the first place, before actually having the disease itself.
On the other hand, secondary prevention involves reducing the impact of current diseases and seeking to prevent future recurrences of events that have already occurred.
For example, quitting smoking after being diagnosed with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease is an example of secondary prevention. Another example is complete cardiac rehabilitation after having a heart attack.
So, the new guidelines address only the primary prevention of cardiovascular disease in individuals currently without cardiovascular disease.
For decades, the consensus of medical opinion was that a low-dose aspirin may prevent cardiovascular disease before it begins. However, recent studies seem to show that this perceived benefit is really negligible while increasing the risk of a serious bleeding event.
Because of these findings, the use of low-dose aspirin is no longer recommended for primary prevention in individuals at low risk for cardiovascular disease, adults older than age 70, or individuals at increased risk of bleeding.
A good example here would be the case of an 80-year-old woman who lives alone and has no heart problems or health problems aside from, well, maybe osteoarthritis. She does not have the cardiovascular disease, as we said. According to these new studies, this 80-year-old patient should not be taking aspirin as a preventative treatment, since again, according to the studies, aspirin is unlikely to prevent her from having a future heart attack or stroke.
As a matter of fact, the studies seem to show that in this patient, aspirin may increase her risk of future bleeding.
Now let's take the case of a younger person, perhaps like yourself, maybe between 40 and 70, with a higher cardiovascular risk profile. Maybe your family history includes premature myocardial infarction, inability to achieve lipid blood pressure or glucose targets, or an elevated coronary artery calcium score.
In this type of patient, the healthcare provider needs to have an informed discussion about the risks and benefits prior to making a shared decision about whether to initiate low-dose aspirin for primary prevention.
So your healthcare provider might just want to consult with the Atherosclerotic Cardiovascular Disease Risk Score guideline.
In short, the new guidelines mean that aspirin is no longer recommended for those without cardiovascular disease. This change affects millions of people.
However, these recommendations do not apply to an estimated 121 million individuals, nearly 48% of the population, that already have cardiovascular disease, including stroke, where the benefits of aspirin are well established. Getting back to the original premise of today's early discussion, we called the media effect. You would not know all of what we just said from reading the headlines, many of which are, in fact, misleading for patients. Here's one headline. Daily aspirin to prevent heart attacks no longer recommended for older adults. Now, you can see that as the headline on March 18th, 2019, on CNN News.
Another example of a misleading headline is Don't Take an Aspirin a Day to Prevent Heart Attacks and Strokes. Suggests that patients should stop taking aspirin. This headline appeared on USA Today on March 19, 2019.
Imagine how many people tune in to just the headlines on both CNN and USA Today. These types of headlines are misleading, if not downright false, for millions of people who should continue to take aspirin as directed. Not to say that everyone was so callous. In fact, some outlets did a lot better than others, including the New York Times, which led with the headline, Daily low-dose aspirin no longer recommended by doctors if you're healthy. That was far better than the other news media.
If you still do not see the significance of all of this and just think big deal, then you need to understand why this is so important. In other words, why should these headlines give us pause?
The reason is simple. Research from the fields of neuroscience and cognitive psychology are instructive. These studies suggest that the brain actively predicts what input it will receive rather than just passively processing information as it arrives. In other words, the first few words of a sentence can bias a person's view of what comes next. That is, at least to me, extremely interesting and important, as we often only get to read the media headlines.
Now, similar studies have shown that the brain fills in the blanks, creating illusions based on context and previous memories to create a picture with incomplete or partial information based on our prior experiences, memories, and knowledge base.
I'm sure that you've heard the term hypoglycemia, or increased sugar in the bloodstream. Well, have you heard of typoglycemia? Well, this is a phenomenon that allows our brains to read and understand sentences even if they are full of typographical errors.
Since the brain tends to fill in gaps, omitting key information from a headline or placing the most important information at the end of a headline makes it vulnerable to being hijacked by a reader's brain.
Not only that, but many readers do not even read beyond the title of the article, with most scrolling through only about half of an article. So what's the result of all of this? Those headlines that we read concerning aspirin are already having an effect on the public.
Dr. Siddharth Sehgal, a vascular neurologist at Lehigh Hospital and Medical Center, recently consulted a patient about treatment for her ischemic stroke, including the need to take aspirin on a daily basis.
Her response? But doc, I just read on the news that aspirin's no longer recommended to prevent heart attack and stroke.
So the doctor explained the real news. But we cannot tell everyone that reads those articles that they are indeed deceiving.
The media really does a disservice to patients by overly reducing complex studies and guidelines to, well, too easily digestible sound bites. Working together, researchers, physicians, and social and traditional media outlets can each do our part to advance patient understanding and improve health outcomes. This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 29 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care. Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show. As a person who speaks on the radio to the public, I, like all others who are on the airways, must be careful not to say anything that could be, construed as sexist. But sometimes there is a medical article that seems to divide the sexes. One such article came to light this week.
It seems that neuroscience has historically had a problem of predominantly using male test subjects to study how the brain works, as well as in studies to find out what happens in brain illnesses.
So, when some medications, for example, are studied, researchers often assume that whatever has been true for the male subjects will be true for the females as well. However, this assumption can be dangerous. For example, take the drug Zolpidem that's used to treat insomnia or difficulty sleeping. You may know this drug by its trade name, Ambien. It was released in 1992 with physicians prescribing similar doses to both men and women.
After a while, women began reporting adverse effects ranging from hallucination to sensory distortions because the drug was not clearing out as quickly from their bodies.
As a matter of fact, in 2010, women accounted for almost 70% of ER visits related to that drug Zolpidem. The question became, why are women more sensitive to it? Now, suggestions ranged from differences in how men and women's liver enzymes work to body weight differences and even testosterone levels. So now, the FDA recommends that women should be prescribed smaller doses than men. But this is not the only medication whose dosing may need to be adjusted depending on the sex of the patient.
Similar issues have come up with different responses to antidepressants, identifying symptoms of autism, and even understanding how Alzheimer's disease happens.
A lot of these differences have been known for many years, so why has it taken researchers so long to study these sex differences that existed in the first place? And with all this in mind, we need to define sex differences. Here, sex refers to the biological condition of one sex chromosomes, with XY generally classified as male, XX as female, and expressions like XO or XXY as intersex.
Gender refers to how one identifies and is influenced by societal and cultural factors. Sex differences in the brain, however, refers to features of the brain like chemical levels, hormone receptors, or immune activity.
Let's take an example. Sex chromosomes affect production of hormones like testosterone and estrogen. Everyone has different levels of both hormones, which can affect all organs of the body, including the brain. And it's not just hormone levels.
There are sex differences in how the brain processes the stress response, activity of chemicals like dopamine and serotonin, and even how the immune system interacts with the brain.
Biological sex simply affects many aspects of how our brains work. There was a 2017 study on sex bias in neuroscience research, which found that for rat and mice models, the majority failed to use biological sex as a statistical variable or even acknowledge the sex of the animal.
Omitting sex as a variable in data analysis means that valuable information about whether a discovery was relevant or not to a particular sex gets lost.
This is really important since psychiatric and neurological conditions, including autism, Alzheimer's, schizophrenia, depression, and even Parkinson's disease, are characterized by sex differences in the prevalence of the disease, its symptoms, and even how effective treatments are. But not everyone agrees that this should be taken into account when studies are done.
For example, Gina Rippon, a professor in cognitive neuroscience at Aston University in the UK, claimed that researching sex differences is a form of neurosexism, and that this evidence of biological sex affecting the brain is a myth.
Many of you remember the 2017 Google memo, I do, which claimed that sex differences in the brain meant women were biologically incapable of being equal to men in performing in the technology sector. Now, segueing from sex differences to telepathy is a hard one, but here goes.
Men and women would often love to know what is actually on the minds of their friends and family members. So telepathy has always been a dream of many in our society, including researchers.
As a matter of fact, brain-to-brain interfaces have existed in science fiction novels for decades. There have been many roadblocks to attaining it. It has long been thought to be a technology only obtainable in our dreams. First of all, we've never had the understanding of the brain as we do now. Of course, there have always been ethical barriers as well, and we'll get to those in a minute.
But there has been some progress made in the study of brain-to-brain interfaces. Most studies seem to start with rodent, and telepathy is no exception.
Studies on brain-to-brain interfaces have been performed in rodent models and even brain-machine interfaces in human studies for several years. Up to now, brain-to-brain interfaces that have been studied in humans were not typically direct interfaces. In other words, someone had to push a button or transmit information in a way other than through the brain interface for the information to reach each participant.
More recently, researchers have been able to directly connect one brain to another.
But until now, these connections had to be physical ones, such as wires linked from one subject to another. Scientists at the University of Washington and Carnegie Mellon University created a brain-to-brain interface system that allows one or more people, called senders, to influence the decisions of an individual, called a receiver, with the goal of helping the receiver play a very simple Tetris-like game that only the sender could see.
So this study makes it clear that a future in which our brains are part of an interconnected social system may be closer than we think.
You may be wondering how they did this. Well, Carmen and I are about to tell you. The senders wore electroencephalography, or EEG caps, which allowed the researchers to measure brain activity via electrical signals and watch the Tetris-like game with a falling shape that needed to be rotated to fit in a row at the bottom of the screen.
In another room, the receiver sat with a transcranial magnetic stimulation apparatus, or TMS, positioned near the visual cortex of the brain.
The receiver could only see the falling shape, not the gap that it needed to fill. So their decision to rotate the block was not based on the gap that needed to be filled. If a sender thought the receiver should rotate the shape, they would look at a light flashing at 17 hertz for yes. Otherwise, they would look at a light flashing 15 hertz for no. Pretty basic, but amazing if the researchers could pull it off. Well, we'd not be here telling you if it failed. With this experiment, the receiver was correct 81% of the time. Then something else was done to make the results even more interesting.
The researchers incorporated a situation where the sender do not agree. That is, where one sender wants to rotate the shape and the other does not.
To test this, the researchers intentionally made one sender less reliable than the other, to see if the receiver could figure out whether one sender was more likely to be correct than the other.
The results showed that the receiver was statistically more likely to act on information from the more reliable sender than from the less reliable one.
So what's the future of all of this? The study could lay the groundwork for multiple-person, brain-to-brain interfaces that allow sharing of more complex thoughts or actions.
Just think about a world where ideas and experiences could be shared directly with other people, allowing them to quite literally walk in your shoes or help you navigate unfamiliar and dangerous territory.
From soldiers to patients who cannot communicate verbally, brain-to-brain interfaces could allow groups to make decisions based on their collective knowledge without saying a word. This is most likely a development that will take years to develop, if ever. As there was with the previous study on sex bias, in research there are also ethical ramifications to consider. After all, ideas and thoughts should only be transmitted between people if both parties agree.
Think of all the recent movies where one group could read the minds of others without the sender even being able to control what he or she is sending and to who the information is being sent.
As this technology develops, the safety and security of the people who will eventually use it should be considered at every step. Remember Tom Cruise in the movie Minority Report. Every so often, at the end of a show, we have a tad extra time and, of course, a somewhat captive audience. So, to end the show, I give you my rendition of House of the Rising Sun. There is a house in New Orleans. They call the rising sun, and it's been the ruin of many a poor boy, and God, I know I'm one. My mother was a tailor, sewed my new blue jeans. My father was a gambling man down in New Orleans. I've got one step on the platform and one step on the train. I'm going back to New Orleans to wear that ball and chain. Thank you. I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain diagnoses. These now include amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, cancer, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, glaucoma, HIV/AIDS, seizure disorders, chronic muscle spasms, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, PTSD, any terminal condition, as well as other ailments and conditions, including certain diseases with chronic or long-term pain. For more information, you can call our office at 641-44 1-1. We have also set up a special website at maridocs.com. That's maridocs.com, where you can get a lot more information on medical marijuana. You can also set up an appointment at Southside Medical Center right on the website. Again, that's maridocs.com. We've come to the end of another Hey Doc show. Carmen and I hope you've enjoyed the past half hour and found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.